podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to the second episode of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? And I'd like to start by thanking my son Jackson for the musical intro you just heard. Nice bit of blues there. Thank you very much, Jackson. This week's guest is Simon Vexner, who is a highly awarded copywriter. He's, among other awards, got the Cannes Grand Prix, a few D&AD pencils, Creative Circle Gold, that kind of thing. He is also the creator of the massively popular Scamp blog, which was absolutely required reading in the world of advertising from about, 2006 to 2010. And he's now a creative director in Sydney, at DDB Sydney. So we had a chat last week touching on all those subjects. So without further ado, here it is. Hi, Simon. It's great to speak to you all the way in Sydney, Australia. Obviously, we've known each other a while, but maybe it would be good to kick off because I think this is a good question to ask everybody. Why did you get into advertising in the first place?
Well, I was just always one of those kids that loved the adverts. I used to run around the playground singing the jingles, although to my memory, a lot of kids did at that time. Like jingles were you used to run around the playground singing either jingles or pop songs. Maybe jingles should come back. I think they work.
Yeah, which era are we talking about? The sort of mid-80s or something like that?
I guess from late 70s through to early 80s.
Yeah, so Hofmeister, Follow the Bear. I remember all my friends at school doing Hofmeister, Follow the Bear.
Yeah.
Ariston and on.
Even A Finger of Fudge. I mean, A Finger of Fudge was a classic that went on for like 15 years. They never changed the ad. They never had to. I could still sing the jingle today, but I wouldn't want to distress your listeners.
It's full of every goodness and very small and neat. See, I can do it as well. And there's that bit in Inside Out, the Pixar movie, where she remembers some chewing gum jingle at random. And you go, it's funny how those jingles, Umbongo, Umbongo, we drink it in the Congo, are just in there forever and they're never going to leave and they have no significance at all. But you're right, the jingles, hugely influential.
Well, now it's coming full circle, and a lot of the latest thinking about advertising revolves around the importance of creating memory structures. And we haven't got back to jingles yet, but some of the world's biggest advertisers, like Mars, think very carefully about, well, what do we want people to remember from this ad, from this campaign? But I digress. There was another really big factor in me getting into advertising was my dad, because my dad used to work for the Sunday Times in London, and he used to bring home their posters, because they had at the time a very cool ad campaign that I later found out had been done by Leo Burnett. The tagline was, "Haven't you ever wished you were better informed?" It was a sort of very Cannes-style campaign, where it was just visuals, just great images, and then the tagline. And I can remember them to this day. So there was Anne Boleyn walking down the aisle with Henry VIII. "Haven't you ever wished you were better informed?" There was two sets of architects standing on two halves of a bridge which hadn't quite met in the middle. "Haven't you ever wished you were better informed?" There was the Trojans welcoming the horse into their city, celebrating as the horse arrived. "Haven't you ever wished you were better informed?" And these, I used to put these posters on my bedroom wall. I just thought they were so clever and so funny. And that's one of the things that I suppose in my mind was always, oh yeah, advertising would be a great thing to get into.
So from there, I guess you went to Watford. What how did you find out about Watford out of interest?
I think that I actually... Did they have the internet then? I can't remember. I think this might have been before the internet. Maybe it was even a career service or a library. Libraries were a sort of place you used to go to before they had the internet.
Really?
But you know, I had a couple of sort of false starts in life. I think a lot of creatives, I mean, many do, but a lot don't go into advertising as their first job, it seems. And I actually started off working in the city, because it was the 80s and I'd seen that movie Wall Street, and I thought life was all about how much money could you make, and could you get your hair to go completely back with the right kind of gel. That was where my headspace was, my hairspace. So I went to the city, I did that for a couple of years, and I actually liked it, but I sort of knew there might be something else I'd like more. Then I tried journalism for a bit, and I also liked that a lot as well. But then I realised that advertising would be for me, because I had actually, it's coming back to me now, I had actually applied to ad agencies as a graduate when I was leaving college, because I was so keen on advertising. And I remember in all the interviews, speaking so enthusiastically to the interviewers about how excited I was about ads, and I couldn't wait to get working on ads. And then eventually, it was at BNP in London, where they actually offered me the job. In the final interview, I remember the MD saying, "You do realise you won't actually be writing the ads, don't you? Because this is a account management job." That was the weird thing about it. In all the brochures they sent to universities, where they had graduates talking about how much they loved their career in advertising, nowhere did it mention that they weren't actually doing the advertising. They were doing the client management. All they talked about was the great brands and the great ads and how much fun they were having. And that's how either dishonest their brochures were, or possibly also how naive I was that I hadn't researched it properly. I thought that these graduate jobs in the big agencies were for creating the ads. I didn't realise that they were for being account manager. And I even got offered one of these jobs, but the job in the city paid twice as much. So I went. The fact that it wasn't writing the ads and it was half the salary, the city job, sent me to the city job. But then when I realised that I liked the city but not that much, I thought, well, I'll go back into advertising, but I'll find out how you get the job where you're writing the ads. And that's what led me to Watford College.
Well, that's interesting, because pretty much exactly the same thing happened to me, in that I sent off a bunch of... I didn't even know what the jobs were in advertising, and I managed to send off all these mailers, and I got an interview with a guy called John Banks, who I think used to be the MD or something of Y&R in the 80s or something, and then he had his own agency in Mayfair, and I met him, and he said, "So what do you want to be in advertising?" I was like, "What is that? I don't know." So I managed to get an interview with this quite high-powered guy, and he was like, "Oh my God, just go to the IPA and find out what the jobs are." And it was that day that I found out what copywriting actually was. But it is odd that you say the same kind of thing sort of happened to you in terms of what is copywriting or art direction as a job. And
I think today's graduates are far more clued up.
Okay.
Far more clued up. Because I remember one of my interviews, one of the people asking me, so how would you characterize the difference between advertising and marketing? And I didn't know.
No.
I had no idea. Very naive. Or perhaps in those days, just the information wasn't available, or I didn't have a mentor who could tell me. Or
So you would, just in case everyone doesn't know what Watford was, Watford is the primary, alongside St Martin's, I guess, college producer of advertising creatives in Great Britain. And actually, my mum went there. So it seems to have a long enough history that it produced a lot of, well, in the golden age of advertising and beyond. So I guess Tony Cullingham was your tutor.
He was my tutor, yeah.
Yeah, and where did you go from leaving there? How did the first career progression step go?
Funnily enough, I had a slightly rocky start, because I was doing really well at Watford. They had this thing called Ad of the Month. And I had won the ad of the month every month. Well, I think they only held it two or three times. Anyway, so I thought I was doing really well. Now, Tony Cullingham, the tutor, dished out placements to students. And that's the way to get a job, or was in those days. You had to get a placement at an ad agency. And he gave the best students the first placements at the best places. And then the next best, because he needed to look good to the agencies.
Yeah.
And the second best team would get the second best placement, etc. He didn't give me a placement at all.
Why?
Well, I don't know Tony that well, or feel I know him that well, but from what other people have told me, he likes to be like one of those football managers who feels he knows how to get the best out of people. And I think, I mean, I don't know this, but I'm just assuming that he decided that treating me mean was the best way to get me to outperform. So although I thought I was one of the best students in the class, and I'd won this, you know, silly out of the month thing a few times, he wasn't rewarding me with getting placements. So I actually became very cross with the course, and I didn't even graduate.
Well, so you left before it finished.
I left early. But I had a partner there, and we were both becoming quite frustrated because Tony wasn't giving us any placements. So then we thought, well, screw it. We'll just have to go out and get our own. So we called people up and got our own placement. And then I went to see all the headhunters. Maybe Tony was right, after all. Maybe he is the master manipulator. Because from a very sort of young age, he persuaded me to, well, don't wait for someone else to do stuff for you. Just get off your ass and make it happen for yourself, which has always been, you know, very important to me. And so then I actually split it up with my partner from college, and there was a job vacancy going at Saatchi's. There was a girl who was there as an art director, and through a headhunter, I put my book forward and met her, and she liked me, and we started working together. Great. So my first job was at Saatchi's in London in about 95.
And so who was the CD at that time?
The ECDs were Simon Dickett and James Lowther. It was just after the Paul Arden era.
Yeah, right. That must have been around the time the Saatchi guys got kicked out. Was it around that time?
Yeah, I had only been there a year or two, and the whole M&C split happened, which was a very strange time to be at an agency, because a third of the accounts, or nearly half the accounts, walked out of the door overnight. Wow. And so did half the people. There were rumours flying around about so-and-so's left. Oh, my God, so-and-so's left. And then, you know, I don't know, Jim's left. Oh, no, he hasn't left. He just went out to get his dry cleaning and he's come back. So it was a very strange time.
And do you think you did any work of note there? What was the stepping stone to the next thing?
No, I didn't. I had a bit of a rocky start at Saatchi's, really. A lot of the other young creatives didn't like me. Because I think it was a bit of a class thing, because I went to Eton and Oxford, and most of the young creatives there thought that made me a bad person, and they were upset with me and didn't want to be my friend. So, you know, being creative means being open-minded and open to all influences, but I mean, obviously they didn't see it the same way. Or maybe they just genuinely didn't like me. It was nothing to do with class at all, who knows. And I had a bit of a rocky time with this partner who I'd gone in to work with, because I later realised, or she later admitted to me, that she found me attractive, and that's why she'd given me the job, which is a bit humiliating.
Well, and also complimentary, but as well as humiliating.
It's also complimentary, and as I also found her attractive, we then started dating for a while. If anyone listening to this is thinking about dating their partner and wondering whether it's a good idea, I'm here to tell you it's not a good idea. Never do that.
So you didn't get married and have two kids, and then
No, it was a disaster, both professionally and personally. Although it was interesting.
Yeah, sounds interesting. So, how long did you stay at Saatchi's for?
Well, it ended up being a total of 2 years because, as I said, I hadn't done any good work. I hadn't really found my groove. I wasn't getting on with this lady that I was working with, who I didn't really rate professionally. She's left the industry a long time ago now. And so I split up from her. So I was a very young creative working on my own. And when half the accounts went out the door and they were looking for people to get rid of, I was, you know, one of the obvious answers. So I actually lost my job, which I'm sure was the right thing for them to do. But one of the CDs who, when he was firing me, gave me a really excellent piece of advice. And I also would hold this out to all your listeners. If you're ever being fired, listen very carefully to what they say. Because it seems to be one of the few times when people might say something interesting or useful. So this guy, his name's Richard Myers, who Richard Myers and Adam Keane replaced James and Simon, who went off to M&C. And so he said to me, well, look, unfortunately, we're going to be letting you go. And I asked, well, look, have you got any advice for me? He said, I've got one piece of advice for you. Just take a look at your book, your portfolio, and decide in yourself, you know, are you happy with that? I didn't know what he was going on about at the time. But looking back on it, what I take him to have meant was, so if you think you can do better than the work that's in your book, you need to work out what you've been doing wrong or what you can do differently, how you can do better, so that you can get a better job and thrive, etc. Or if you're happy with the work that you've done in your book and you don't think you can do better, then you probably need to go maybe to a worse agency or to a different career or something like that. Reading too much into it, he probably can't even remember. Saatchi's was really good at that time, and there was a lot of really good work being done around me, but not by me. So it was after that comment that I did take a little look at myself in the mirror and, you know, thought about, well, what can I do to improve? Because I had maybe sort of felt a little bit entitled. Oh, straight out of college, gets a job at Saatchi's. So what I did to improve was I thought, well, how can I have better ideas? It's all about how good are your ideas. And then I realized I didn't actually know what an idea was or what it was supposed to be. And this is very common within advertising. People are constantly talking about ideas. They're constantly saying, oh, we need a different idea. Or, you know, we need more ideas. We need some ideas. The client doesn't like this idea. We need a bigger idea. We need a different idea. But no, I think a lot of people don't really know, well, what do we actually mean by the word idea? What does that mean? What is that thing we're looking for?
What do you think it is?
Well, I remembered that this 18th century Scottish philosopher called David Hume had written a chapter in one of his books called On Ideas. Because I'd studied philosophy at university, philosophy in French. Unfortunately, I didn't study very hard because I was interested in other things, but I remembered this one bit. So I actually still had the book on my bookshelf. So I went to the book on my bookshelf. I looked at that chapter called On Ideas, which I recommend anybody look at. And it was gold. I don't know if he's right or not, or if there's some other theory that's better, but it spoke to me. And it set out a very simple explanation of what is an idea and how to have them. And I sort of followed that, not religiously, but to a greater or lesser extent, for the next 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, today I sort of feel I've absorbed it, so I don't sit down and think about David Hume when I'm writing ads. Though I do teach about David Hume to students, because I'm now teaching at Miami Ad School a little bit. Yeah, so that really helped me to improve. That dead Scottish philosopher guy helped me a lot.
Well done, David Hume.
Yes.
I feel when I chat to Dave Trott at some point in the future, he's going to bring up David Hume for different reasons. Because whenever you have a chat with David Trott, he always brings up philosophers and he seems to have this fluent knowledge of them. And my brain has to just start to work a lot harder when I'm having that chat. But we'll find out at some point. He didn't mention the ideas thing, but it's interesting that Aristotle has a whole bunch of stuff that is the groundwork and foundation of any screenplay as well. So yeah. Everyone go back to philosophers. So you left Saatchi's and then what happened?
So I found a new partner called Nick Alsop, who became my partner that was been my main partner that I worked with for years and years, I don't know, maybe 12 years. And we got on really well together and worked really well together. We first got a job at a small shit agency for a year, and then we got a job at a big shit agency called Ogilvy for a year. It's apparently better now, but it was pretty shit then. And then we got into BNP London, which later became DDB. And we worked there together for 7 years. And that was where we started to do work that, you know, was people liked or won awards or whatever. And then after that, we went to BBH for 4 years. So those were probably my best, those were my best times with a partner, my years with Nick, when we were at BNP and then BBH.
And so how did you go from sort of small shit agency to, well, I guess maybe that's not such a weird leap to then a big shit agency, but how did you go from a big shit agency to a one of the best agencies in the world, really, at that time?
Well, to go to the small shit agency, very weirdly, the guy who owned that agency put an ad in Campaign that creative team wanted.
How
odd. No one ever advertises in Campaign.
No.
It's one of the strangest things about becoming a creative, that the job is never advertise.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, if somebody is looking for an engineer or traffic warden, they put an ad online or in the newspaper. Copywriters never. But this guy was quite an unusual guy. The full text of his ad, which I remember well, said, creative team wanted, no wankers. And this guy, who had a lot of rows with at the time, I've since become very good friends with on Facebook, and he's an awesome guy called John Carver. He's a larger than life character, big guy, sort of from a real working class London background, full of bluster, no idea what an idea is at all, but very good at selling, and directed a lot of pop promos back in the day. Yeah, I mean, obviously he had to have a lot of bluster, a lot of character to write an ad that would say, you know, no wankers. And we arrived at the interview there, and he put the reel on, and we were looking at the reel, and we were thinking, oh my God, this is terrible. How can we get out of here? Just when we were thinking how to get out of there, he came back in the room and looked at our book and said, all right, I'm going to give you guys a shot. So anyway, we worked there for a year. And then we went to Ogilvy. I can't remember how we got into Ogilvy, but how we got into BNP was quite interesting. So Larry Barker was the creative director of BNP at the time. And there was a separate thing called the Cannes Young Lions competition, which is still going. And we entered that, Nick and I, and we won that. So we became the team that represents the UK, the Cannes Lions. And Larry Barker had been one of the judges for the Cannes Lions. So when we got back, I wrote him a letter that said, you just judged all the books of young teams in the UK and thought that, you know, ours was the best. Therefore, can you now, well, surely it makes sense that you should give us a job at your agency. Nice. Otherwise, you're being inconsistent. And he wrote back and said, yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense. Fine, come on in. I mean, obviously, he only said that because his junior team had just left, which was Rob Potts and Andy Jecks. And this is of the key thing I now realize about getting a job. You can only get a job if there's a vacancy. So if I'd written that letter to Larry Barker, yeah, it was sort of hopefully a fairly witty letter. If I'd written it the month before, it wouldn't have had any effect. But because I happened to write him that letter when his junior team had just left, he had a vacancy, so yeah, he got us in.
Yeah, it's interesting. People have likened it to trying to park your car in Covent Garden on Saturday night. You could drive around for hours and hours never finding a space, or you could just see a space in the middle of Long Acre just when you needed one. And I think that serendipity of circumstance and timing is something that... but you've got to make your own luck as well, haven't you? You wrote that letter and you won the Cannes Lions thing, so you were in the position to take advantage.
I've always tried to have a lookout for where I can tilt the machine somehow. This is an analogy that I sometimes think of from pinball.
Yeah.
If you just stand in front of the pinball machine and press the flippers, you can never get a good score. You've got to push the machine a little bit so that the ball moves in your favor. You can't push it too hard because it'll tilt. But you just got to nudge the machine a little bit. And that's what I've tried to do throughout my so-called career. You're making opportunities for yourself, see where... I think, you know, I'm part creative, part traffic guy. I've always, whenever I've gone to an agency, tried to make friends with the traffic people. Because this was a piece of advice that one of the creative researchers gave me years ago when I said to him, do you think it's important to be in with the suits or do you think it's more important to be in with the planners? And he said to me, no. Get in with traffic. That's what you need to do because then you get the good briefs. Anyway, so I mean, I've always sort of gotten well with people in traffic anyway, but I also, every week I tried to get hold of a list when I was at BNP of what's going on, what are all the briefs? Because you could see from that any new briefs coming in. Mm-hmm. And you can also see, oh, such and such a presentation, work not bought, it's go again, blah, blah, blah. So every week at BNP, I would look through the traffic sheets and see, well, what interesting briefs are there around where there's an opportunity? And then I would ask the traffic guy, hey, could we take a look at that brief? And I think a lot of creatives don't do that. I mean, going back to Tony Cullingham at the beginning, you know, a lot of creatives wait for Tony Cullingham to give them the placement. And a lot of creatives in an agency will wait to be given a good brief. And in the pub, they sit there and say, oh, we're never getting the good briefs. Don't wait to get good briefs. Just find out where they are and ask if you can work on them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Just to cover this little part of the story, how did you meet Nick then?
I think that was through a headhunter, actually. The headhunters, one of the headhunters had a list of people who were on their own and looking. And his partner had just left to go to Amsterdam, I think, possibly. And I'd broken up from Helen, so we were both on our own. We met, we straight away hit it off, and great friends ever since. I'm not going to say we never argued, but pretty much most of the time we got on really well and did good work together.
If anyone listening to this doesn't know, during their time at BNP. Or DDB. When did it change from BNP to DDB?
It changed from BNP to DDB while I was there.
Yeah, so during that time, you and Nick produced, you know, a lot of pencil winning, really good work, particularly for VW, if my memory serves me correctly. And one of the things that I can speak to you, if not uniquely about, then something that you've done a lot of other people haven't done is win a Cannes Grand Prix. And I think that's actually the time I first met you. We were in Cannes at the same time, and we were either at the same dinner or I met you in the Ritz-Carlton. I think you and Patterson had some champagne and kindly gave me some, and I think I was there with Gabby. What's it actually like to win the Cannes Grand Prix? I think back in those days it was more special because there were fewer of them. But what was that experience like?
Well, I think that's a very good point about there being fewer of them. And the other rule that there used to be was that you would decide which category to enter something into. So you would win a Grand Prix for outdoor, say, and that was it. Whereas today, everything's entered into multiple categories. It's entered into media, it's entered into PR, it's entered into
promos,
activations. Yeah. And I think that, you know, inevitably, just by economics, cheapens what it means, because obviously the more supply there is of something, its value goes down.
Absolutely.
But, you know, leaves are less valuable than gold bars. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more of them. But I don't mean to sound like, I'm not saying like, oh, things were better in the good old days. I mean, in many ways, things are much better now. But in terms of that specific point, the value of Cannes Lions, yeah, I think that obviously they were worth more then. And what it feels like to win one, I just feel, you know, fantastic. I mean, I've always loved going to Cannes. And going there as a winner is great. Because one the dark side of award shows is that, you know, even if you've won a silver, you're always feeling slightly insecure of, oh, someone else has won a gold, someone else has done a better. I mean, creative people are very insecure in general. And you're always thinking, I'm always personally at award shows thinking, oh, I need to do better next year. That was probably the one year that I didn't do that. So it was great in that sense. It quietens the insecurity.
And did it change the nature or the kind of your standing in the agency and the kind of briefs you got, or were you already at a decent level for that kind of thing?
BMP was very, very egalitarian, which I love. They had a great system, for example, which was, you know, there were multiple CDs, but if you could be a CD and working on a brief, and so this other team would be credit directing you on that brief. But then they might be working on a different brief and you'd be creative directing them on that brief. So people creative directed each other. And people helped each other a lot. So, you know, and another ad that Nick and I did that won quite a few awards was this one for King Kong, for Volkswagen Polo, again with King Kong. And we had that concept pinned to our wall for a long time. Another creative kept coming into our office. Well, this dates the story, the word office. Anyway, another creative kept coming to our office and saying, oh, that's really good, you should try to get that up, etc., etc. And if it wasn't for him coming in and being supportive and praiseful, probably never would have happened. It was a very supportive environment. It was competitive. There were a lot of great teams there, and we all wanted to beat each other. It was very, very friendly and very close bonds and very, you know, collegiate seeming. We didn't realise it at the time, but I think it was paradise for creatives.
Yeah, and you were working, I've heard a lot of people talk very fondly about working for you and Jeremy, and particularly Jeremy. And what could you talk about that a little bit, how they were as bosses for you?
Ah, Ewan and Jeremy were just awesome. Awesome. I mean, they were only CDs together. I'm a huge fan of both of them. And, you know, got on great with both of them, learned a huge amount from both of them. I mean, Jeremy was probably a CD for longer because Ewan left after a while to go to BBH. I mean, Jeremy is just a master. A lot of creative directors are really bad. It's one of the jobs that is the least well done that I know of. And there's people make so many mistakes and some of them are so obvious. I mean, it's the classic case where, again, you know, Football Manager is a good example, where somebody could be a great footballer and then doesn't become a great manager. Whereas conversely, there can be, I mean, Arsene Wenger was a very average left back by all accounts,
yeah,
but has been a great manager. Some people can be great players and great managers, but they're very different skills. And so Jeremy was a great creative. He's done tons of awesome ads. He was a great creative director as well. He never tries to write the idea for you. That's the prime thing that most creative directors do wrong, is they get frustrated because the team are not cracking it, and then they have an idea.
And all that does is kills the team's motivation immediately. It's the worst thing you can do, because then you just turn them into stenographers rather than creative.
That's the most basic error. All he would ever do is critique your idea. The other thing he does that's so key, but it sounds simple, but it's so key, is he just says no a hell of a lot of the time. He used to call him Dr. No sometimes. He would just say no again and again and again. He never gave a shit about deadlines, pressure, clients, agents. Briefs been around so long. No, 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 no. Sometimes that was the only creative direction he would give. But setting very high standards is probably the most important aspect of the job. And he did that.
Yeah, I've heard that Colin Millwood in the golden age of CDP was the same thing. And he said, it's not good enough, do it again. Perhaps a little bit more abrasively than it sounds like Jeremy did it. But then the person would go, what's wrong with it? And he'd go, you work it out. And then say, come back.
Now, Jeremy would sometimes say what was wrong with things. Because again, I think it's really shitty to not give people feedback. I mean, how do you expect them to improve? I mean, they might do just by working harder or longer. And so saying no in and of itself is useful. But he would give feedback. He would say, oh, I think it needs to be more emotive. Or I don't think it's saying quite the right thing. He would give very simple feedback.
That sounds really good. And was it around this time you started the Scamp blog?
Yes. So yes, it was.
Why did you start that? And you must have been an utterly lone voice in terms of a creative advertising blog at that time.
Yeah. Well, the reason I started it is because the internet had started. I mean, I remember seeing the internet. We were given the internet at the Saatchi's in about 1996. And I remember thinking, oh, this will never take off, because it was just so slow. It would take 20 minutes for the Man City website to load. And I couldn't be asked. I mean, I didn't want to wait 20 minutes to read a newspaper article. I would just buy the newspaper. When the internet reached a certain speed, then obviously it became amazing. But I was in BMP, which was at the time a very traditional agency. This was even before they had Tribal, and later when they had Tribal, that was separate. So all the digital stuff was being done separately. So I had the sense that this exciting world of the internet was beginning, and I wasn't a part of it. And I was intrigued by it. So I love learning about new things. And also, I suppose, there was a little bit of a fear of, well, am I going to get left behind now? If the internet is going to become the new thing, and I'm not doing anything in that area, but just TV and posters, will I get left behind? I better see what it's all about. So I started Googling the internet and advertising, and I discovered blogs. I discovered Russell Davis's blog, which I thought was awesome. It still is awesome. And there was no one to tell me not to, so I just thought, well, I'll do a blog then and see what it's like. I'll just give it a go. So I started my own blog. I came up with the word scamp because it means cheeky, and it also refers to advertising in that a scamp is a thought that you just sketch up quickly. I don't know if anyone even does that anymore, but back in the day, used to scamp up an idea on a layout pad. And so I just started writing this blog. And as you say, I was a lone voice. I was the only creative writing a blog at the time. And it was probably for that reason, rather than through any intrinsic quality of the blog, that it became popular. It was the only one. Until then, there hadn't been a forum for people to look at ads the day after they came out and discuss them in public. We did it always in the pub. And yeah. We would talk to our mates, what do you think about that ad? Well, I think it's shit, well, so do I. But now suddenly there was a forum where you could discuss in public with all the other creatives what we thought of the latest work and other issues that were pressing to creatives, such as, you know, what's going wrong in a relationship between creatives and planners, or what's the best way to sell an idea? None of these things had ever been discussed. They'd been books. There'd been individual conversations, but there'd never been a public forum. So Scamp just exploded. I was getting thousands of hits from all over the world, and I was getting more hits than Campaign. Campaign had only just started, and they hadn't got their website worked out. Yeah, look, and I was even getting people contacting me saying, how can we advertise on Scamp, production companies and the like? Because they realized that all the creatives were reading Scamp. I mean, I sometimes used to worry, what if people are reading it and they'll get cross to me? And they did. At times I wrote, because you can't write a good blog unless you've got strong opinions, and if you have strong opinions, then someone is going to be offended here and there. So sometimes I used to get bosses, this was more at BBH, really, where I, shortly after starting Scamp, Nick and I left to go to BBH, where sometimes the bosses would get cross with things that I'd written, or it upset somebody, or I used to sometimes wonder if John Hegarty was reading Scamp, because it seemed like the whole industry was. I remember thinking, I wonder if John is. And then one day he came to my office, because we had an office two doors away from him. We had Nick Gill was next to us, and then John Hegarty. He stormed into my office one day, and he'd been there for about a year, saying, "What you wrote this morning was absolute rubbish." So then I realised he was reading it. But it got me into trouble at times. So I had a call from the MD once saying, Dan the planner was in my office almost in tears over what you wrote about him today. I was like, what? Dan the planner? I'd look over what I'd written. That wasn't about Dan the planner. I'd written about something completely different. But he had assumed it was about him. And he'd gone to the MD to complain. So journalism is a very different arena to advertising. Journalists don't work collaboratively with the politicians they write about or the sports people that they write about. They're a gadfly on the outside. When I was in an ambiguous position, I was an insider working with planners, working with account handlers, working with clients, but also trying to be the gadfly that would point up where things were going wrong or how things could be better. And that was an awkward position. I don't know if you found the same in your blogging career.
Well, it's interesting because I wasn't actually aware of your blog when we started ours. And I think, I say we because it was Luna BBO's blog initially, even though I wrote like 99% of the posts. And I think the reason we did it was to kind of make a name for ourselves because we were quite a small entity at that point. So there was a slightly different motivation. And then pretty soon after, I think at the time when I was getting like 60 readers or something like that, someone explained to me there was this thing called Scamp. And I checked out and I was like, wow, this is really amazing. And I think part of the problem came with comments, because if you just left the comment thing on, you didn't really have a lot of control over people with their axes to grind and people slagging each other off. But because it's like your pub, people would then kind of blame you for any other opinions that happened on there.
Absolutely.
And I think there was a bit of divisiveness going on there. I think there were people who, they might have had an axe to grind with me personally. I don't really know, but we definitely get some comments that were a little bit worrying. And then, you know, you don't want to turn off the comments because that was the vibrancy. I remember there was some ad you guys were talking about, or you were talking about, and it blew up to about 200 comments, and it was all about, I think it was that bear, moonwalking bear ad. And it just blew up because people were saying this has been ripped off this or it hasn't been ripped off that. There seemed to be a huge conversation about people ripping off ads in those days. And yeah, there were certainly some things that got me in a little bit of hot water. And then the other interesting thing was when I was freelancing, and people would ask me, you know, do you not think you're going to ruin your chances of being hired here and there because of the freelancing? But I found it was far more beneficial to put a strong opinion out there, assuming it was, you know, going to be an intelligent opinion or an interesting opinion, not something that people wouldn't find either interesting or thought-provoking. And I got offered jobs as a CD a lot on the back of having done the blog. You know, the work had to be good as well, but I think people could see what I thought was good and why I thought it was good or bad and what those opinions were. And I think that really helped. But, you know, I guess I've calmed mine down a lot in the days since. I think I've run out of things to write about to a certain extent. But also,
the first thing is very interesting. I mean, it sounds like you were going through the same thing. I mean, I was very naive at the beginning, and I was learning how to handle comments, as indeed the whole of the internet was and still is. Yeah. Comments is still a very vexed question even today, and different websites have different policies. And, you know, my Scamp was shut down by Google at one point.
How come?
Over a comment that someone complained about.
What was that? Oh, maybe you can't say.
Well, you can Google it. I mean, I don't want to bore your listeners with the story, but it shows how het up some people get about comments. And did I have the right policy on comments? I had to change my comment policy several times. And so I did learn some painful lessons. But like you, the blog was definitely beneficial to my career. It probably put some people off. But in the main, because it contributed to me, you know, getting a big reputation, that's probably helpful. In the world of P.T. Barnum that we move in, having a big reputation is probably as important as being good at doing the work.
Well, I think, oddly enough, it coincided at a time when the creative was being more and more marginalised from being the rock stars of the agency and the rock stars of, you know, advertising in general, particularly through the 70s and 80s and to some extent the 90s. And that seemed to be sort of petering off around the same time in terms of, you know, like Mother wouldn't credit individual creatives. And so there seemed to be less of a point where people were getting to become names. You know, when I started in advertising, you knew who John Gorse and Nick Worthington were, or Steve Hudson, Victoria Fowler, people like that. And it felt to me like the blogosphere, you know, particularly for you and me, was somewhere where you could make a significant kind of imprint of yourself in the industry. And I was kind of surprised first that there weren't more people doing it. And now that I've calmed down and Scamp isn't, you know, the cultural touchstone that it was in those days, it seems weird that people haven't jumped in and tried anything.
Yeah, I mean, the point about creatives being marginalised is an interesting one. I mean, the whole industry has been marginalised to some extent. And obviously, you know, the changes in our industry have been enormous. And many of them are objectively for the worse. For example, getting less money.
Yeah.
No one can say, oh, that's a great change.
Yeah.
I mean, people often say, oh, things better. The default position that you have to take is things are much better now, because the internet has opened up a whole new world of amazing creative opportunity. But it's not debatable to say, well, you know, we now get less money. As to whether that's better or worse, I don't think that's really debatable.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing that really sticks in my mind, the story that I heard about Peter Mayle, the guy who wrote A Year in Provence, when in his autobiography, he talks about, yeah, life was pretty good. I was 26, living in a house in Sloane Square and had a salary higher than the Prime Minister. Now, no 26-year-old in advertising today, a 26-year-old in advertising today would be earning a tenth of what the Prime Minister owns. The house in Sloane Square, forget it.
No way.
Peckham. A young creator, I was talking to a young creator the other day who told me that he bought a house in Peckham. I was appalled. You know, maybe that's the trendy place to live in London now.
I think it's just where you know, people starting off can afford.
Yeah. So, the financial reward, I mean, the reason the financial rewards were so great is because looking back on it, we were working in a monopoly industry. Especially in the UK. Well, Channel 4 came along in the mid-80s. And obviously BBC One and BBC Two were non-commercial. There was only one commercial TV station. It was literally a monopoly. And as we know from economics, any monopoly industry makes excess profit.
Yep.
And that excess profit, a lot of it, was going into, you know, Jaguars and suede jackets that the creatives could swan around in.
Yeah, and I think now there's a, you know, there are huge numbers of people, and the spread of advertising through the different media has made that thing, you know, far from a monopoly, but also who's doing what and how and why, and it's so difficult to kind of pin down now.
The change of now that I see, the biggest change, is exactly what you just said, the fragmentation. So with the internet and technology, you can do very cool stuff. There's no doubt about it. You can do stuff that couldn't be done in 1978. And creativity thrives on stuff that's new and different and original. So in that sense, it's better. But it's not being projected on a big screen in the marketplace. And one of the things that's really rewarding for creative people is a lot of other people seeing your work.
Absolutely.
That used to be that in the UK, you do a TV ad and everyone had seen it. Everyone.
Yep.
Put an ad in the centre break at Coronation Street, another one used it 10 years after a few. It was the same in the US before cable, when the networks, you only had to buy two or three spots and half the country had seen your ad. And that not only made advertising more effective and cheaper, but it made it more fun for the people doing it. You felt you were making more of a difference. Because people today are doing very cool shit with technology and online, but not many people are seeing it, and that's less rewarding.
Yeah, I think it's the taxi driver test that a lot of us, you know, if a taxi driver says, what do you do? And you say, I work in advertising, and they go, have I seen anything you've done? And you could answer that with something that they've seen. That's fantastic. But if you've done a experiential takeover of a town square in Amsterdam to whatever, there's no chance, obviously, that they've seen that at all. But I find it even weird because when Nike Plus came out and won lots of awards, I was into running. I was, you know, an Apple fan. You know, I thought, you know, I'm square in the target market for this thing. I didn't find out about it until it won lots of awards. And I was kind of like, how did that not reach me? I'm like, bang it. And I work in advertising as well. So it feels like there's definitely a gap in terms of things becoming famous, even if they're incredibly good and incredibly well done.
Well, it's just really hard to reach people nowadays. It's just economics. There are many, many more channels. It's harder to reach people.
Do you think, I'm just going to chuck this out there as well. When cigarette advertising came in, the restrictions seemed to open up new vistas of creativity for people because we can't do this, so we're going to do that instead. And it made people think in a much more lateral way. Do you think the kind of, the fact that everything's available to everyone now in a lot of ways, and if you want to take over a town square, if you want to do a cinema, whatever, it's all there, is actually a little bit paralysing?
I don't know. I don't know if it'd be paralysing because, I mean, there's so much new territory that you can explore now. I think that ought to make it easier. I mean, trying to do another Silk Cut poster, which was a very restricted form, and 150 had already been done. That's hard. Yeah, whereas now, I think, you know, obviously technology and the internet have opened up huge new fields, and I think there's definitely, I find it very, very stimulating and exciting, all the new things you can do. But the fact that people aren't seeing them is disappointing, or not many people are seeing them. Because we're all in it partly. I mean, just personally speaking anyway, as a creative, we're praise whores. We want approval and recognition.
Yeah.
I used to get a buzz if I had a poster campaign out. I used to get a buzz if I was going around London in a taxi or walking around and you see your poster.
Yeah, that's great.
And you know, the knowledge that a lot of other people were seeing it was very, very rewarding.
Yeah, I'd go and take photos of my poster. If I knew my poster was up, I'd go and find it and take a particularly to things like The Economist because it felt like it was a really, you know, big, significant thing to do. In most 99% of jobs, your work isn't out there for people to see and consume. So, particularly on huge billboards for people to enjoy.
Just to be really clear, in my opinion, the work that's being done today is much more creatively interesting than the work that was being done before the internet came in. It's incredible. The type of thinking, the type of ideas, the possibilities of it, it's mind blowing. What in the era of TV, it was sort of the same thing being done again and again, slightly differently. So a 30-second TV ad, if it's like a little play,
yeah.
Obviously the theatre's still interesting. You still get great plays. And you could go to the theatre every week and it would still be entertaining, but you'd always be going to the theatre. That's what a 30-second TV ad is like a little play. Whereas today, if you're coming up with a great advertising idea, it could be it could be a Wi-Fi snail or displaying an ad on the moon. They're much more different to each other than 30-second TV ads are to each other.
Yeah, and talking of new things, I guess your move after BBH was to emigrate to Australia.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that move and why you did that?
Yeah, well, my wife's Australian and she wanted to move back. And I resisted for a long time because I didn't like Australia. I mean, I like it a lot. I love it. But I always very much felt myself as a Londoner. I very much identify with a cosmopolitan, multiracial, dynamic, left-field creative place. And I love London. And I didn't want to leave. But my wife said we had to. She gave an ultimatum. So we had to leave. And I mean, I love Australia. Sydney's very different. It's none of the things that London is. But it has other great things about it. So, you know, you can't beat the weather. The lifestyle is much better than London. It's better for kids. We've got two kids. The work's probably not quite as good, but it's very good. It's probably only, you know, it's probably in the top five advertising countries in the world.
Yeah.
So I came back here. I came back to DDB because I knew Dylan. I knew Dylan from BNP London, and he'd taken over Dylan Harrison as ECD of CDB in Sydney, and so he, when I said I was going out to Australia, I just put it out on Facebook, going to Australia, and he said, oh, well, come and work at CDB then. So I was hired over Facebook. Yeah, a lot of people say that the advertising industry is too chummy, and that's not true at all. And so I've basically been at DDB for the last 6 years with a couple of breaks. So I had a break of 1 year where I went to Naked, to the ECD at Naked, and I had a break of 1 year quite recently where I set up my own social media business, Hungry Beast. But now I'm back at DDB again. So the reason I set up my own social media business is because I'm starting to worry about longevity. The advertising industry is theoretically, or by cliche, a young person's game. I mean, there was this famous article in Campaign saying that only 10% of the ad industry is over 40, and only 1% is over 50. And obviously, that 1% is over 50, you know, it's probably the CEO and you know, some old guy in the studio that no one's quite sure who does, but still there. And so I started to think, oh my God, what's going to happen to me? Where do all the old creatives go? I better do something of my own so that I have some kind of runway going forward. And we talked about Scamp, and I've always been into blogging and social media. So I thought, well, I'll do something in the social media space because I like that and I think I'm good at it. And it's expanding, it's exploding. So I set up a social media business. And it did okay financially. It was actually fine financially. I was getting sort of the same salary as I was as an agency CD. But I realized after doing it for a year that I sort of, as far as running a business goes, I'm rather lacking in the business skills that you need to run a business, unfortunately. So a lot of things were falling over. And also I realized I didn't just want to do social media. I mean, I love social media. I don't want to just do social media. So now I'm back at DDB again.
So those business skills, do you find a partner to set this thing up with, or was it just your thing and you employed people? How did the building of that business?
It was just me, and I now realise it would have been much better if I'd had a partner. And I have actually been talking to a couple of people about partnering up. So that could be something that happens in the future. But yeah, I mean, the classic agency startup is three people, a creative, a planner, and a suit. I don't think social media necessarily works in quite the same way, but there should have been at least somebody who is more business-minded than me. So I lack a lot of those skills.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that worries me. Not that I've never had any inclination to start any kind of agency, because the idea of all the shit you've got to keep in your head is just, to me, just something that I find very off-putting. It's, you know, you're employing people and you've got to think of employment law, and then you've got to find some premises, and then you've got to continually find accounts, and are the accounts going to leave? All those kind of things. That when I was at Luna for 3 years, we had a lot of that stuff, but with the safety net of BBDO, whatever it happened to be. So it wasn't really doing exactly that thing. But I just, all the things that you have to do aside from, say, being a creative or making sure the creative work is good, was, you know, enormously time consuming and actually yep. very difficult. And yep. I think it's fair to say that I was never trained to have those kind of skill sets. And the reason why people like you and me have gone into, say, a creative business is because we're, say, creatively minded, and we want to do lateral thinking and come up with those kind of solutions. The idea that someone has said, well, you know, we've got this much of a profit and loss account, and that means if we hire this is it's a completely different skill set. So
absolutely. I totally agree with you. I mean, yeah, one thing I learned is that suits do a hell of a lot that most creatives don't know about, and yeah. that I probably wasn't doing. I think a lot of creatives wonder, well, what the hell do suits do all day? Because obviously the only thing that matters is the ads, and they don't do those. And when they talk to the client, well, nowadays we're in the room as well presenting the work. In fact, the suit often just sits there saying nothing while we present the work. Maybe they take minutes, maybe they don't even take minutes. They just, believe me, they do a hell of a lot. I'm in awe of good suits and what they do.
Yeah, when we did Luna, and I think actually it would be an amazing exercise for any creative at whatever stage, if they haven't done this, to see what the business side of it really is like, because you then discover why losing this account actually doesn't really matter, and gaining that one makes a huge difference, and where is the money going? And I remember things like, I think I was told at some point that when Peter Suter was in charge of AMV's creative department, he simply had a budget of £3 million and was able to distribute it however he wanted. So if he wanted a very heavyweight team of 300 grand each, he could, that was 600 grand of his money gone. Then he could have three, you know, younger teams who were on sort of 16 grand each or whatever it happened to be. But the financial responsibility of a smaller agency and the constant need to make that system work, otherwise people get fired or they made redundant, is a huge pressure on top of all of that. Obviously, it's worked for a lot of people who have started agencies, but it seems to go somewhat against the central vibe of being a creative.
It does. I mean, no one's good at everything. I mean, some creatives have some of these skills, but no one's good at everything. And that's why we have these partnerships. I mean, the strategic mind is very different as well, getting a planner involved. I mean, some creatives are very strategic too, and some aren't. Some are more executional. So I do believe in this old rule of three of having a creative mind, a strategic mind, and a business or client centered mind. Whether all this will hold true in the future, though, I don't know, because the agency model probably needs to evolve radically. I mean, this is one of my favorite parlor games, if you like, with friends sitting around, discussing, well, what should the agency of the future look like? And I don't think anyone's got the answer.
No, and I think it's also interesting how when people start places off, they kind of feel like they've either got a niche or they've found a niche or they need to find, and they are the only ones who do this particular thing. And I think when it comes down to it, most advertising agencies kind of do something pretty similar to most other advertising agencies at their fundamental core. And then, you know, people then try and make a some sort of branding stand that we're the ones who are into this or we're the ones that do that. But fundamentally, I wonder if the job has really even changed that much, even through these technological changes and advances.
I totally agree with you that most agencies are very, very, very similar in the way they operate. They have the same departments. They probably have similar ratios of those departments.
Maybe a few on the edges that are different. I mean, perhaps I get the feeling that Wyden and Kennedy perhaps spend more of their budget on creative talent than some other agencies do. But that's just a feeling I have. I haven't seen their books. But things may change in the future. They may change radically. Going back to my dad's experience at the Sunday Times, he lived through the whole newsprint revolution where they got rid of all the printers.
Oh, yeah, that was huge.
No newspaper had been put together for hundreds of years without printers. Yeah. Printers were felt to be a vital part of running a newspaper. Then they all went overnight when new technology came in that meant that type didn't need to be hands typeset.
Well, we've passed the hour mark, and I think we've kind of neatly got to the present day in your life and career. So I think, you know, we could possibly wind it down there, unless there's anything else that you particularly wanted to talk about or discuss.
Yeah, one more thing I want to say.
Yeah.
There's not many forums I could say this in, but this feels like an appropriate one.
Okay.
There are a few public figures out there in advertising, people who have blogs, people who do podcasts, people who do talks, who are sort of big reputation as creatives or creative thinkers, who I think are making dangerous oversimplifications. Because if you want to have a successful blog, you need to have a message that's very punchy and controversial, almost Trump-esque. But some of these people are putting out dangerous yet seductively attractive oversimplifications.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. Because, I mean, I was reading an article, it's funny that you say that, because a couple of days ago I was reading an article about how binary all this is. It's either this or it's that, and also to get your voice heard, you're going, well, digital's dead, or experiential's dead, or everything's all about digital. In fact, I remember 2007, everyone said, digital, if you're not in digital now, you're a dinosaur and you're screwed and whatever. So there's always another angle to it, but you're right, to be heard and to stand out, that kind of means you end up reducing the nuance of the argument enormously, and you need the nuance of the argument.
There's one famous ad commentator whose shtick is, online advertising is shit, and only TV advertising is any good. All these online people are saying that TV is dead and everything should be online. Now, no social media or online or digital people are saying TV is dead. No one's saying that. He is he's dressed up a complete straw man and he dances in front of the camera. to make people in that world look ridiculous. No one's saying it's the progression is the same as it's always been, which is a new medium arrives. The same has happened with TV. TV didn't kill, newspapers didn't kill radio, but it arrives and a lot of people watch it and a lot of ad spend goes there. And all the media mix adjusts. That's all that's going to happen with online. Yes, yeah, it's risen to 50% of media spend. It might rise higher because it's more than 50% of eyeballs. Mm. So it might rise higher. But no one's saying that TV is dead. And to say that online advertising is shit and doesn't work is just idiotic. He's saying that to get heat. It annoys me.
Okay. Well, on that bombshell / note, whatever. So thanks so much for your time. I think there's a lot of really fascinating stuff in that last hour or so that, you know, people of all levels and stages could really get their teeth into.
Stuff, you can edit it out. Feel free.
Yeah, I'll edit out all the shit bits. Maybe we'll be left with 15 or 20 minutes. Thanks very much. And let's have another Skype chat at some point soon, Simon. It's been really good to catch up.
Yeah, let's have one that's more personal, social, and emotional rather than business.
Do that, and I won't record that one.
If you want.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Cheers.
If this is a podcast, then watch Christmas.